You wouldn't. Standing over here from Mr. Goldsmith.
Is it? And was bought at some point, Rebecca Watt.
Oh, we didn't have her on the list.
Right.
Who is she appearing for?
Perhaps I can explain, Commissioners, there's a fairly significant chunk of time this morning. When I first requested it, it was in light of the panel's instructions that a planner should do one brief, because Mr. Brownham should all come turn up at once, and he has five different counsel involved in the different clients he represents. So I requested length of time anticipated that there would be five counsel and Mr. Brown. The other counsel have picked other times, and this chunk of time stayed. So
right.
Hopefully we won't take it all, but I am going to take the opportunity to pick up on some issues from last week, having thought about things over the week. Obviously for the panel to organise this proceedings, Commissioners, but I again have this unusual situation where I have clients with O&L and urban breakdown issues and clients with rural living issues. And I've been working with both Mr. Farrell and Mr. Brown on the rural living things. And I've elected to do my legal submissions on O&L and urban breakdown today and my legal submissions on the rural living issues on Thursday. Ms. Walt and her clients are more interested in the Rockaby Basin and rural living issues. So if it's okay with Pam, we'll suggest that I present legal submissions on the O&L UGB issues. Mr. Brown can then answer questions on those issues. And then Ms. Walt will give her legal submissions on the rural living issues, and Mr. Brown can answer questions on the rural living issues.
Right.
And you just won't have the benefit of my legal submissions on the rural living issues.
Yeah. Do you intend also to call Mr. Turner this morning?
That's...
because we...
Yes, sorry, yes, I had forgotten that.
But we were going to advise that we had no questions of Mr. Turner. We hadn't realised that he was coming this morning. Otherwise, we would have told you earlier and saved him the trip. But
so Mr. Turner can leave?
Yes.
Your evidence has been read. That's it, but I've seen the question.
Normally takes people longer to persist than that.
You can start.
Okay. It's an efficient process.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good day.
And also, just to clarify, is Mr. Baxter appearing being on Thursday?
And again, to a degree, his evidence underpins some of Mr. Brown's planning evidence on the rural living issues.
So at the end of which, if some of our questions have not been washed up, we can do a washover then?
Yes. I mean, we're back here on Thursday with Mr. Baxter, Mr. Farrell, and myself on rural living what to be based.
Just thinking about whether it might be more efficient by counsel to think about this. It might be more efficient to hear counsel one after the other and then have Mr. Brown answer questions on the totality of his evidence.
Entirely in your hands.
And with the appropriate counsel to chip in depending on what point in particular he's addressing.
Have you met?
Yes.
I'd like to start off, Commissioners, by reverting back to some of the issues discussed last week. I'm happy to acknowledge that I made some submissions last week in relation to some fairly stringent policies which I perhaps made the mistake of thinking were so obvious that they didn't need to be thought about too much. And we ended up with a fairly interesting discussion on King Salmon and other aspects with too much category of knowledge I hadn't prepared properly for. And that has led me to get some serious consideration of those issues since Thursday. And I propose to, because they are also relevant to Mr. Brown's evidence today, I propose to, shall we say, answer some of those questions again in a different way, and I hope provide some particular assistance on the relevance of King Salmon to these proceedings.
Mr. Goldsmith, before you roll on, because of the intermixed, could you please just confirm which submitters you're representing today, so I can be sure that I've got a note of that?
Well, they'll be on the front page of the submission, but they're the Ebon Farm Estate Limited, Bridesdale Farm Developments Limited, Sugar River Country Limited, and Mount Cadrona Station Limited.
Thank you.
If I could hand some materials up.
Sorry.
Just to clarify, Mr. Gosser, so that this is just response to the matters that were raised last Thursday. Okay.
These are talking points that I wish to speak to, and perhaps we might be debating from last Thursday. And I set out at the top the first two are in particular an objective and a policy, which I submitted on last Thursday, and which ended up having a bit of a debate about King Salmon and things. The issue being, in the first objective, it's absolute protection aspects from subdivision use and development, and the second policy, the reference to exceptional cases. I have added 6.3.4 because Mr. Brown and I were discussing last night for quite some time some of the implications of what happened last Thursday, and we were looking through the other policies and objectives. We actually came across 6.3.4 to protect, maintain, or enhance the district's outstanding natural landscapes. And we spent some time debating whether, in fact, that objective is ultra vires the Act, given that it effectively restates Section 6B in a more stringent manner. 6A talks about preserve, 6B talks about protect against inappropriate development. And I think there is certainly an argument that that objective actually rewrites 6B in a more stringent manner than 6B anticipates, and could be ultra vires the Act. I'm not going to form a final view on that this morning, Commissioners. I'm leaving it there to think about, because I actually think the Council has a much more significant problem, which is its evidentiary basis. Point two, I talked about the current regime, the very stringent ONLWB regime, which I talked about last time, relating to development pressure and location topography. There was a question from Councillor Gilmore about what could also be under pressure in the future. The point I'm making here is that if you read 1805/99, that regime was a combination of development pressure and topography. It's the circling mountains that are so close that surround the basin, and planes fly over the basin, and you can start to reach out and touch the mountainsides. Wherever you are in the Waitakere Basin, you look up and you see those surrounding mountain slopes, which are very close. That was the aspect highlighted by the Environment Court in C1809, and there's a very different factual context in Wanaka, with its wide, wide open spaces and far more distant views. The next point was in response to Commissioner Nugent, and he put to me that the current plan has the inappropriate in almost all locations comment stuck in a weird position right at the beginning of Chapter 1. The point I should have made there, having thought about it, is that comment in the current plan is a reason for activity status. It's not a policy. What happens under the current plan is there are the policies which then drive activity status, and then, as a result of that analysis, some activities are discretionary, and then there's that kind of funny statement at the beginning of the plan that the reason they're discretionary is that they're inappropriate in almost all locations. But my point is that it applies after policy determination of status. It is not a policy which drives the termination of status or influences the termination of status.
Mr. Goldsmith, I understand the point you're making. Just something that immediately occurred to me, that if that were the case, that statement in Chapter 1 of the ODP, if anything, would justify non-complying status. I think back in the old days, those with sufficient grey hairs to remember the Town and Country Planning Act and the tests for specific departures.
Specified
departures, can't even remember the language it's so long ago.
Section 74.
I would agree with you, Commissioner. But can I interpret, can I add that? I mean, I was one of the senior counsel involved right through when I had about 99 and the 2 years of hearings that followed. And one of the issues, one of the big issues that was decided by the court early was whether non-compliant status was an appropriate activity status in the rural general zone. The problem was the court had no evidence on landscapes. It says it had no evidence on landscapes. And it had no basis for determining where ONL started or finished. It didn't have the evidentiary analysis of the landscape to be able to decide whether activity should be non-complying or discretionary. And we ended up with what we call the fully discretionary regime, which, right through the rural general zone, which in actual fact, in the ONLWB, is harder than non-compliant. There's no doubt about that. And when you get down to the lower parts of the Wakatipu Basin and other areas, it's kind of at the easier end of discretionary. So we have a fully discretionary regime that through its policies and assessment matters actually ends up creating de facto non-compliant right through to de facto discretionary. And in fact, then you can put this to Mr. Brown and Mr. Baxter. Certainly the local professionals consider it to be a very appropriate way to approach landscape issues in this district. We are always designing and considering different factual situations. My submission, and I think it's concurred with most of your Section 32 information, is that, generally speaking, it's worked pretty well the last 17 years. But it comes from that peculiar C108/99 with an environment court. And to be fair to the then council, this was almost the first big environmental case after the Act came in, when the environment court basically said, you must first of all establish the facts, and you must first of all establish where the ONLs are. And the environment court had no evidence to do so. And my second bullet point there, the second point I make is that almost all locations is a quantitative measure. A rural landowner or a farmer could apply for a farmhouse or a barn or even a non-farmhouse and easily meet an almost all locations test, because if he ends up with consent, there's still no house in almost all locations on that rural area. And you can have quite a number of houses and buildings out in the rural area and still easily comply with the almost all, the inappropriate almost all locations, because there's so much of it. My submission is that exceptional cases is a completely different test. A farmer applying for consent for a farmhouse or a barn can easily meet almost all locations, but how does he possibly establish that it's exceptional? It's just a farmhouse or a barn. Big difference. Again, the exceptional...
Excuse me, Mr. Goldsmith. I wonder if the argument could be made that it's exceptional because it's so wide. That, as you say, it's just a farmhouse. Whereas, if the norm is something more elaborate with a larger profile, then that's what that policy is directed. I'd like your comment.
Well, it might be. I like the definition of exceptional. But to my mind, an exceptional is something that stands out and is different from other similar ones. Does concept of exceptional start to bring in precedent? I think exceptional is a very, it has connotations which all I'm really saying here has connotations which are different from almost all. Because almost all is quantitative, whereas exceptional has a qualitative measure about it. And I can see a lot of argument about that, especially with the question you just asked me. It's just, I think it's a dangerous phrase. Now, and I also, in my third bullet point, remind you that the exceptional cases in the current plan again applies at the assessment stage, after determination of policy, and after determination of status. And it applies as a consequence of the ONLWB policy regime, which has what we call the reasonably difficult to see test. So if you look at the ONLWB regime policies, which are very stringent and almost impossible to get through, and then go down to an assessment matter, a list of assessment matters, which says you only get there in exceptional cases. It flows and follows from the ONLWB policies. And it's quite and it is quite appropriate against those policies. Of course, the ONLDW, district-wide, policies are very different. And the exceptional cases assessment matter doesn't apply in the current plan in the ONLDW. And the fourth bullet point, I just said exceptional case, I think I've just said that. It flows from 1.8.99, that's meaning it's different from almost all locations. And my submission, elevation to a policy direction. And I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying it would have to be supported by adequate evidence if you were going to spread that test district-wide. Point three, I just ask you to consider the consequences if the above policies are retained. And just going back to them at the top, you know, protect the qualities of the ONL and ONF from subdivision use and development. It's extraordinarily stringent. The second one is the exceptional cases one, very, very tough. And the third one is protect, maintain, or enhance the district's outstanding natural landscapes, which is also extraordinarily stringent. So I'll just make that point. Point four of my submissions, what I refer to as King Salmon 1. Now, my junior, Liz Hill, was quite keen to have her first presentation to a hearing. And she was quite keen to take on look at the points that were raised. We lodged some submissions late yesterday. Did they get circulated? No.
They may have.
No.
Right. I wasn't sure whether that
may have got put on our filing system. But no one told me.
Sorry, we lodged them mid-afternoon. I thought you might have had a chance to read them before this morning.
No. Sorry.
Perhaps I can hand them up.
Yeah.
Hill's submissions, sir, and she's going to present them and defend them.
Okay, good morning. First of all, I just want to say apologies for the lateness of accepting all of these submissions. I've also just this morning sent through cases that are relied upon in these submissions, so you should find those at some point when they come to hand. Due to the lateness of the circulation of these submissions, I'll just take the opportunity to walk through them, and as goes for work, feel free to interrupt.
Well, I wonder if I could interrupt at the outset. I'm one of those people that absorbs things better if I read it. Could I just ask if you'd give me 2 or 3 minutes to read what you see before you present it?
Yes,
that's
fine.
Thank you.
want me to walk through them. I will, however, take the opportunity to make one clarification point and then provide what I think is the most useful one-paragraph summary of these submissions. First of all, you'll see here on the first page that I refer to Objective 3251, and I just want to equally say that these submissions also relate to other provisions in the proposed district plan, which purport to provide for a more stringent level of protection than that afforded through what is expressed in part 2 of the RMA, such as those that are referred to on Warwick's submission points 3 of Naldia. For example, 6312 and 634 objective. So that was my clarification point, and now I will summarise, hopefully, I hope, that these submissions seek to really state what we understand to be the ratio of the Supreme Court and King Salmon and its application to the panel's inquiry into this district plan review. Of key importance to that is that King Salmon provides authority that a planning instrument prepared under the RMA can provide a more stringent level of protection than that is worded in part 2. We are not contesting that. What we are, however, contesting is that that should not be done unless there is a substantial evidentiary basis to do so. So I'll draw your attention, therefore, to paragraph 3.2. Whilst it is possible to provide provisions in the plan which are more stringent than those in part 2 RMA, that must be done so after careful analysis and application of the purpose and principles of the RMA. The panel's role in this inquiry is to seek an optimal outcome of sustainable management. In arriving at such a decision, it must be considered whether Objective 3251 of the PDP, and again, I restate that that is equally applicable to other provisions, whether that those provisions accord with the objectives of sustainable management for Part 2 of the Act and fits well with various considerations under Section 6, 7 and 8. I then also draw your attention to the final sentence of para 4.7, following the page. King Salmon, in the Supreme Court's majority decision, does not change that statutory requirement of giving effect to sustainable management, nor does it justify Objective 3251 as currently drafted. Again, I come back to my first point, that such a stringent legal protection requires a substantial evidentiary basis. If there are any questions on the supplementary,
thank you, Ms Hill. I want to take you first, please, to your paragraph 2.1, because I think you may have misunderstood the reason why I raised inappropriateness in my discussions with Mr Goldsman. The suggestion I made was that Mr Goldsman think about whether King Salmon was a reason why the more onerous, more restrictive objectives and policies of the ONLWB zone in the operative plan should apply district-wide, because the Supreme Court's clarification of what inappropriate means in the context of Section 6B is more or less exactly what the objective for ONLWB says, namely that it's protect against everything except minor and temporary effects. So it's not... So in terms of the submission Mr Goldsmith was making, that inappropriate should be inserted in order to avoid the restrictive effect of the ONLWB, the proposition was, well, doesn't King Salmon get you to the same place anyway? Now, that's not a question, I appreciate that. So the question sitting behind that is, do you have an issue with that chain of reasoning? And if so, I'd invite you to tell me about it, because I'm looking for assistance in making sense, because I freely accept Mr. Goldsmith's point that we have to have a practical outcome here, and as say, I'm reading the case and I'm trying, scratching my head and trying to figure out where that takes us. So that's the proposition I've put to you. I invite your assistance.
Thank you, Commissioner Robinson. Just want to start off by saying I don't, of course, have a problem with the reasoning of the Supreme Court and consent. I do, however, think that of relevance is this subsequent line of jurisprudence, particularly in the Environment Court, which has distinguished King Salmon's reasoning, and in particular, its definition of inappropriate. Those cases have tended to distinguish that definition that the Supreme Court proffered of inappropriate, meaning something which is either negligible or temporary on an O&L, to be in the context of the coastal O&L, which was subject to those avoidance policies of NZCPS, in particular policies 13 and 15. Furthermore, as Commissioner Nugent brought to our attention last week, that definition proffered by the Supreme Court is also problematic somewhat in that it is quite circular. The purpose of providing what is inappropriate has to be determined in accordance with what is being sought to be protected. So putting that aside, I'm not saying that that definition of inappropriate is not applicable and or that it's incorrect. I'm saying that in the context of district plan review, and with respect particularly to Objective 3251, inserting the definition of inappropriate into that objective, I don't think will lend itself to the same interpretation as that which was offered by the Supreme Court in the context of the coastal rolling out.
That's helpful, thank you. One question I put to you, firstly a clarification in relation to the Basin Bridge Board of Inquiry. I cannot recall a discussion of inappropriate. I'm not saying it's not there, but I wonder if you could give me a reference. I did read all 400 and whatever pages of it, but that one slipped past me.
The relevant excerpts I've got of that decision are pages 84 to 87, and paragraphs 176 to 188 in particular.
Thank you. I'll read those with interest. The other proposition I wanted to put to you was that on the basis that it has been distinguished in a resource consent and designation context, is it more difficult to distinguish it in a plan chain context, given that that was exactly what the Supreme Court was looking at, albeit against the background of the NZCPS?
That's a very interesting question, yes, and it is important to make that distinction here, and I will further add to that by saying that this is a district plan review, not a plan change. And we are not subject to the operative district plan for Queenstown. We are, however, subject and required to give effect to the operative regional policy statement and to have regard to the proposed regional policy statement. Those are the relevant higher order documents here, and the RMA, of course. We are not, however, subject to the operative plan. We're not required to give effect to it. We are not required to respect the NZCPS. And you'll see there at the end of my submissions, I also talked to the case of Ngāti Kahununu, which, as Commissioner Nugent mentioned last week, proffered authority for the proposition that a plan can provide absolute provisions or objectives. And once again, that was in the context of a higher order planning instrument, namely the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management 2014. And I guess one could draw an inference here that we are starting to see stronger central government direction in these national instruments, which are perhaps providing stronger avoidance-type policies in light of Part 2 of the RMA. Now, the Queenstown District Plan Review is not subject to such a higher-order document. One could, for example, foresee that there might be in the future, say, an NPS on urban development, as which is currently being discussed by NFE. However, that's not the case at the moment. So I think, helpfully, the distinction...
Just
of the fair tax mix applies.
The district plan is subject to the national policy statement on freshwater management, isn't it? It may not be directly relevant to the issues we're discussing here, but we do have to give effect to that. And there are some other NPSs. But you mentioned the operative and proposed regional policy statements. Where do we get to if the proposed regional policy statement becomes operative during the period that we're hearing submissions?
First of all, thank you for clarifying that we are subject to those other instruments. Yes, I meant my submission in the context of these particular objectives. And second of all, the line of reasoning, the cases which discuss the weighting of higher order documents, to my understanding, sort of reflect the stage at which a document is at in its preparation as to what weighting it should be afforded. And the idea is that a newly proposed higher order document, which might be in its infancy, such as the proposed RPS is in at the moment, having only just gone through hearings without any decisions being made on it, will be given very little weight. My understanding is that once rules become operative, and that's different to having legal effect, that those will have to be given effect to in this district plan.
But
and that's quite
there's
difficult.
No rules in a, there's no rules in the regional policy statement.
Sorry,
what I'm more interested in, but it is the practical position that we are put in if, and it's not an impossibility, the proposed regional policy statement becomes operative prior to us making the recommendations to the council.
And cutting to the chase, as the chair is wont to do from time to time, the proposition that Mr. Winchester for the council advanced was that if the proposed of RPS becomes an operative RPS, at any point up to the day before this panel releases its decision, we would then need to give effect to that now operative RPS. I'll reframe the chair's question as, do you agree with that proposition or disagree? And if you disagree, can you give us the reasons why?
Thank you for clarifying the question. I do agree with that proposition from Mr. Winchester that should your decisions on proposed issue plan come out post the what is now proposed RPS becoming operative, you would have to give it all the plan would have to give effect to that operative statement. I guess one could draw on what Warwick mentioned to the panel last week. You might remember the opinion of Dr. Somerville in the context of the All Community Plan and what some might call an interesting interpretation of those provisions. But I think that, and that was with respect to the weighting to be afforded to the proposed policy statement and the operative Auckland policy statement in the context of the unitary plan. It's quite different to the situation.
That panel is in a somewhat easier position than us in that situation because they get to make the decision on both of them.
That's right, but they still had those requirements in the Act to give effect to the operative statement.
Yes, but obviously you can do that if you're making both decisions at the same time. I expected you to come to that conclusion. What I'm really coming to is, are we to disregard or give no weight to the reasoning that the words in the proposed regional policy statement until the very point at which it becomes operative? Or should we get some give some consideration to the wording as it is now, with the possibility that it might change, but that would be something, an evidentiary matter we should receive, perhaps.
You are required under the RNA to have regard to the proposed regional policy statement and to give effect. So you, in making informed decisions under the RNA, must turn your minds, I think, to the wording of the proposed policy statement as it currently is.
I would add, if I may, if there's a conflict between the operative RPS and the proposed RPS, you must give effect to the operative while having regard to the proposed. So I think the operative still trumps the proposed if there's a conflict.
I challenge anyone to find a conflict.
the
of the operative.
Yes, the other thing I would add is it's probably even more complicated than that, because at the moment the proposed RPS has a certain amount of weight because it's been subject to submission, no decision. It ends up with decision subject to appeal.
Yes.
It kind of gains weight, but it still hasn't got there.
I still have a suspicion that any appeals could be dealt with in the period of time that we're faced with before us.
Possibly.
Diverted by the RPS, I think the issue with the operative RPS is that it is a lengthy document that, with all due respect to the Regional Council, doesn't actually say a lot. I think the Environment Court has commented on that from time to time. Hence, the Chair's comment. Any inconsistencies, because the operative RPS is consistent with most things. Where I get back to, the question that was running through my mind, and I can't recall it, is, did the policies that the Supreme Court were considering in the CPS use that inappropriate language, or was the Supreme Court actually interpreting Section 6B?
The policies don't appear inappropriate, and that, I think, was the whole purpose of the Supreme Court's inquiry, was because they purported to avoid outright rather than a qualification of inappropriateness. Then, should the Supreme Court go back to that qualification, which resides in Section 6B? And in doing so, the discussion on inappropriateness in Section 6B can be found at
the next point of my submissions. Because I've got to address exactly that point.
Para 29 of the Supreme Court decision. And as Warwick's mentioned, he's about to go on to discuss that. Our understanding that discussion of inappropriate in Section 6 as limited to the context of which the decision was made, namely within the NZCPS and relevant to coastal OLs.
Well, I suppose the follow-up question then is, if the NZCPS doesn't use the word inappropriate, but obviously Section 6B does, and the Supreme Court have given us guidance as to what inappropriate in the context of Section 6B, and that we have to give, recognise and provide for the matters in Section 6B as the Supreme Court have defined them. Doesn't that present rather a problem for us in distinguishing the Supreme Court?
Well, I resubmit here that I don't think that the matter of distinction is actually problematic, because what the Supreme Court found was that the NZCPS had gone through a rigorous Part 2 assessment in the determination of those policies, which determine that having the government having gone through that part two qualification and analysis and coming out with those policies, they shouldn't have to revert to part two and make more rule board judgments in light of subsequent plan changes. That situation is quite different to the current district plan review, where I'm saying that there is authority to provide provisions in a plan which are more stringent than 6B. However, to do so must be done by going through a part two analysis and arriving at that conclusion and justifying it.
Another strand is that one of the exceptions that the Supreme Court admitted of, where it was legitimate to go back to part two, notwithstanding the general orders, was if the document in question, the higher order document in question, did not comply with the Act. No one had in fact argued that. I imagine that the respondents probably rather wish they had after reading the decision. But one way you could reconcile these provisions, I think, is that if appropriate had a broader meaning in the context of Section 6B than the Supreme Court identified, then those avoid policies without qualification would be inconsistent with Part 2. Does that argument have any legs? Will that chain of reasoning have any legs? Or is there a different explanation for the interrelationship between the Supreme Court's reasoning and what they said about Section 6B? Or put another way, why did they go to Section 6B anyway? Why was it necessary given the reasoning as you described it?
I'm not sure if I fully understand your question, sorry,
Commissioner Robinson. Well, I don't blame you. I'm trying to make sense of it on the fly. The point is that if King Salmon is capable of being reasoned as you've described it, the court's comments on the wording of meaning of the word inappropriate in the context of Section 6B could be argued to be overdone because they weren't necessary to the chain of reasoning. Now, I think it would be a bold submission that we could ignore the Supreme Court, but is that a valid consideration? That it was part of the court's introductory discussion of the Act and didn't actually go to the heart of their reasoning. Is that another way of reframing the way of the proposition that you put to them?
That's an interesting way of framing our proposition, and I don't think that we are contending that it's overdone. I think that we are distinguishing that the analysis of Section 6B in King Salmon is relevant to the consideration of coastal allowance. And therefore, the definition that Supreme Court proffered for inappropriate is not likely to lend itself the same definition in the context of the objectives and policies of which our submissions are about today.
Thank you for that.
And 2.1, could you clarify where the your conclusion assertion that we've indicated our reluctance to do so in light of this interpretation. Where does that come from?
Thanks, Commissioner Sinclair. I think that perhaps was clarified by Commissioner Robinson's first opening statement, that his clarification was his question last week put to Warwick and I was about the meaning of inappropriate and what effect that would have in reality if inserted into the objectives, which are the subject of this submission. So I apologise, perhaps I overstated the apparent reluctance in 2.1.
To be fair, my junior counsel, that was the way I interpreted the comments that were made as well, so perhaps it's just a matter of...
We're conducting an inquiry. haven't reached any decisions that I've been aware of yet, or a reluctance to do anything or nothing.
So, I think the only fairly conclusion we've come to is that we're not going to tell the Supreme Court that they're wrong.
Can I take that and lead into it? Because point five, King Salmon 2 is my attempt to answer that very point that you raised about ignoring King Salmon. I had pondered upon the OBIT issue. I came to the conclusion that if the Supreme Court says something, even if it's over, it probably carries a fair amount of weight anyway. So I think probably there is an argument that there's an element of OBIT about what I'm about to talk about, but I'd rather put that to one side. I'm submitting that there are two legal aspects.
Sorry, Mr. Goldman. Sorry, I hadn't finished.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. The 4.6, and the Chair raised this a bit just in regard to the giving effect to the NPS freshwater management and the NZCPS. Are the arguments that you set out here, do they relate just to the issue in terms of inappropriate and in regard to landscape, which we're discussing here? Or does that wider in terms of how it would potentially apply for all NPSs, or for that matter, RPSs?
The point of para 4.6 is just to clarify that whilst that decision, Ngāti Kahumunu, which was in light of the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, did interpret those policies within the NPS as being absolute, if you like. The point, as you'll see in the preceding paragraphs, is to distinguish that interpretation of those avoidance or absolute policies with respect to what is in that document and how that relates to the landscapes which we're considering, which I'm saying those landscapes don't need to give effect to the NPC then, unless of course we're talking about, say, Kawara Oane, which would need to. And second of all, is drawing a comparison with the court's reasoning, the Environment Court's reasoning in that case, which pulled from the regional council's functions under Section 30 of the RMA, which when you read through them, are again much more absolute than a district council's function of integrated management, which resides in Section 31. Integrated management, I then go on to offer, has been used synonymously with the term of sustainable management, and that takes you back to an overall broad judgment approach under Part 2. So that's the point of those references to that case and the NPC then.
Thank you.
Isn't the the basic reasoning of the Environment Court in the Ngāti case that an objective, I think it was an objective, can be strict and focused on protection, and that the objective that they replaced wasn't one that sought to achieve balance. Isn't that the real authority that you take from that?
Yes, yep, I think that is the authority. And once again, we're not contending that the plan cannot provide for absolute objectives or objectives or policies which are more stringent than that expressed in part two. We are, however, saying that the analysis to arrive at that conclusion needs to be supported by an evidential basis.
I don't recall there was any evidential basis, particularly in the Nakahanuri case.
I think
I may be wrong, but that was to do with the protection of the water quality in the aquifer. And I don't recall there was any evidential basis on the actual effects or otherwise on the quality of the aquifer.
Commissioner, if I could add to that answer, I think the point is that the stringent, the objective you're referring to in that case came from, and I think the Snow Regional Council requirement to maintain and enhance. That was the higher order. The higher order requirement in that case, from memory, was that the relevant higher order provisional document was a interpreting.
Yeah.
Required the water to be maintained and enhanced.
Okay.
And therefore, because that was the required thing that had to be achieved, you could therefore have an objective and require it to be maintained and enhanced.
I should perhaps disclose at this point, I was the decision maker at the first instance.
You probably know more about it than we did.
Well, no, because it wasn't argued at the first instance. That's fine. I'm just trying to get an understanding of that particular part of it.
Well, my memory was that there was a high order document that required maintain and enhance the water quality. And therefore, an objective which required that was entirely in order because it implemented the higher order requirement.
Can I suggest, Mr. Goldsmith, you probably need to reread it because the objective was in the RPS.
Mm.
And so the only possible higher order document would have to be the NPSFN, and I'm not sure that was the basis for it, but equally, to be fair to you, I think that the Environment Court did support cultural evidence that supported the objective, not water quality, not scientific water quality, but it was in relation to the intangible cultural issues. And since we're in disclosure, I should disclose that I was acting for Hawke's Bay Regional Council, not in, specifically in relation to this appeal, but in relation to parallel proceedings, so I know a little about it as well.
Okay.
Point five, away. My submission points then. King Salmon 2. My submission, there are two legal aspects of King Salmon directly relevant to your inquiry. I've quoted paragraph 101 here, which, as I read it, is about inappropriate in 6B. It's not about the NZCPS or anything else. Whether it was obligatory or not, the court we've often talked about the meaning of inappropriate. And it says we consider the term inappropriate as used in the context of protecting areas from inappropriate subject use or development. The natural meaning is that inappropriateness should be assessed by reference to what it is that is sought to be protected. And I think that's a very, very important statement. I think part of what the environment, the Supreme Court was saying was, when it ended up going away from the overall judgment, was keeping in the values of an ONL, they don't necessarily get outweighed by a good economic outcome somewhere else. But I believe that that statement, from my submission, that statement about the meaning of inappropriate is significant and you must be thinking very carefully when you are applying 6B and devising policies that flow from 6B that will state in this plan what should or shouldn't be allowed, that there is reference to what it is that is sought to be protected. And that's a fundamentally factual analysis. I mean, for example, if there are large ONLs that contain big farming properties, then it would be important, and I think your draft district plan does identify the characteristics of those farming activities as being something to be maintained and encouraged, and therefore the policies and objectives you frame mustn't prevent that. It's very important that you identify what it is that you are protecting, and then you devise objectives and policies that protect what it is you are trying to protect. And that is fundamentally a factual exercise in terms of the ONLs, in terms of going out and finding out what they are, what their characteristics are, and what it is about them that needs to be protected.
Mr. Goldsmith, two propositions for you. First, I think that you may have understated it a little, saying, well, that the protection of an ONL is not necessarily to be outweighed by economic propositions.
It's not to be outweighed.
The necessarily was the thing.
I mean, the principle is quite clear on that point.
Yes, indeed. And so that body of authority that started with the Genesis wind farm in South Auckland, that says you can, in effect, offset ONL effects with other Section 5 issues. I don't think you could say it was now good law. But more to the point, is the way forward then, picking up your proposition, we need to focus on what it is that is sought to be protected, I think I posed a question to Mr. Dwight on Thursday about whether it's the qualities that make a landscape outstanding, and in an extensively farmed area that's part of an ONL, the existence of the farm and the farming activities are part of what makes it outstanding. And the proposed RPS gets somewhere close to the same point, talking about the values that are significant in that particular landscape, and saying they should be avoided, and other values that are not so significant should be avoided, remedied, or mitigated. Is that a way forward?
It is, subject to, which is what I'm getting to, an accurate analysis of what the ONLs are. I make a note there because the answer to the question was put to me. Is C-188/99, and I quoted that paragraph 69, does it remain good law? My submission does remain good law, provided you read it appropriate as determined by King Sam. And my second point that arises from King Sam in my submission is that this panel and its inquiry must be extremely careful about using the word avoid and phrases such as avoid any adverse effects on. I think after King Salmon, those words carry a very strong effect. It's particularly concerning given that the majority judgment tried to kind of read down the stringency of avoiding any adverse effects by saying, well, if they're negligible or transitory, that probably doesn't apply. And in any event, some uses may enhance the naturalness of a landscape, which imply that positives versus negatives weighting exercise and the minority judgment expressed some fairly strong concerns about the way the minority judgment had read down the stringency of that statement. And I must confess I had some sympathy with the minority judgment.
Is the practical answer is the majority is the majority is the majority. They are the court for all practical purposes, and if their guidance is that avoid allows for minor effects and temporary effects, then we should take that on board as well.
I think we have to until somebody goes back and tries to sort that out. But in any event, all I'm saying is that the other thing to be very careful about is use of these phrases.
Can I interrupt you, please? So you say avoid on its own might be too strong, but does that mean you have to go all the way to the tripartite, but instead go to avoid or remedy? Would it mean that you wouldn't actually be accepting a detraction from the values, which mitigate allows a degradation? Remedy would not.
All I'm saying is that avoid means avoid, and you need to use it carefully. Don't liberally sprinkle it through provisions. I mean, it's easy planning speak to avoid, avoid, avoid.
I understand that. I'm asking you another question.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the particular circumstance you're dealing with. I mean, if you're looking at a characteristic or a value that needs to be protected, and you decide that things must be avoided in order to protect it, you're entitled to do so. It's not a question I can answer generically. What I'm saying is it's a very tough hurdle, and you must make sure that you have the factual basis upon which to impose such restrictions.
If, just continuing on from that, if it is contextual and difficult to determine, is it appropriate then to always say avoid, remedy, mitigate?
I'm not necessarily. No. I mean, for example, the ONLWB provisions, actually the existing ones, kind of went through a process and ended up with a conclusion that as long as it was reasonably difficult to see, it would not adversely affect. I think the ONLWB does exactly the required process. If you read those policies that end up with it must be reasonably difficult to see, then it hasn't used avoid, remedy, or mitigate. It's actually said, as long as it's reasonably difficult to see, it's okay. It kind of went away from the statutory language and came to a specific that just happens to be factually specific to the Waikato Basin and no one else.
Well, Mr. Goldsmith, is that another way of saying, and this is a proposition I was going to put to Mr. Brown, but so he can think about this, that the key thing, if you're going to use the word mitigate, is to specify what degree of mitigation is required or permissible.
If you can, yes.
If you can. And the provision you just referred to in the ODP does just that. The mitigation is that it's reasonably difficult to see.
Yes.
And that's what's acceptable. That is the degree of mitigation that's acceptable on the face of the ODP.
Correct.
And whereas if it had just said avoid, remedy, or mitigate, it could have been a lot of mitigation or very little mitigation or anything in between.
Correct. I mean, the more specificity you can have on the policies, the better. Otherwise, we end up with debates. Policy 6341 talks about, well, there's an objective, protect, maintain, or enhance the district's outstanding natural landscapes. That's 634. And 6342 says, recognise that large parts of the district's ONL include working farms and accept that viable farming involves activities which may modify the landscape, providing the quality and character of the ONL is not adversely affected. What does that mean? Does it mean that anything to do with farming is okay? It's a funny juxtaposition, a proviso. It just says providing the quality and character of the ONL is not adversely affected. You've then got to figure out, what does that policy mean? Which quality and character of the ONL is it protecting? And does that include working farms? It was just when I was struggling last night trying to figure out how you would implement it or achieve it. Anyway, I'll move on. Point six, which is, in my view, an important point. I suggest to you that there is a lack of evidentiary basis with a stringent O&L district-wide provisions that I've quoted at the beginning. And I've referred you to Attachment A, Commissioners, and as I assume you have read it before, I won't read it out. But I would ask you just to read Attachment A. Just take a few minutes. Excerpts from the four primary landscape reports of informed or inquiry about methodology.
Goldsmith, having read those, I wonder if they're entirely on point, because they, as I read those extracts, they're all about where you draw the O&L lines and the extent to which the landscape architects had or had not, had or did not have a robust basis for where those lines draw. Plan. I understood your suspicion to be broader in the sense of that it was going to the point as to, well, what are the demands on O&Ls once you've classified them, wherever they may be. Have I misunderstood it?
Well, I'm raising a separate issue here with these excerpts, Commissioners, because I guess to cut to the chase, 17 years ago, this council got, I think it's polite to say, fairly heavily criticised by the Environment Court for not doing the factual assessment on its landscapes before setting up to do policies and objectives. And those are the four reports that inform the district plan review. And as I read those extracts, which I read as very clear warnings from three experienced landscape architects to the council, they start from the existing plan, and we know there was no evidence from the O&Ls in the existing plan, because the Environment Court said so, and then they go around and tweak the boundaries, and this district still has not gone out and done a first principles analysis of the landscapes of the district in order to examine, to determine which is O&L and which isn't, let alone, can I add, the qualities and characteristics of any particular area of O&L that needs to be protected. And I would have thought that those extracts, because where I'm going to on this is we have a plan, and I don't know whether it's 95%, I'm glad you sent out a memo finding out whether it's 95% or not. We have a plan, but let's just assume it's 95%. 95% of the district is O&L, and despite the importance of landscapes in this district, the fundamental importance of landscapes in this district hasn't done what other districts have done, which is to go out and analyse their O&Ls and determine their O&Ls. And on the basis of that, we end up with 95% as O&L. And I'm raising that as an issue because, to my mind, or my submission, we must draft policies and objectives based upon a factual assessment. The Environment Court always says that, start with the facts. and you've got some very stringent policies and assessments, policies that I've quoted, and when you read the landscape assessments, in my submission, the factual basis just isn't there. And how on the basis of those reports are you even then able to identify the specific characteristics and qualities that need to be protected, possibly in different areas? If they are all ONL, they're kind of, the different ONLs are different characters.
Do we need to? Do we need to, a factual basis of identification of the particular values and characteristics of each part of each ONL? Or can we be satisfied that each one will be different and will have their own? And that's a key point of inquiry.
Provided, which is where I'm going. Perhaps if I can just continue, I know I'll answer that question, but if you just get there logically. My point seven, which is kind of the answer, is that the current ONLDW landscape category, which itself was not based on evidence, because the environment had the same problem last time, contains an element of pragmatism. I put it that way. Yeah, it says, develop where it can, the landscape can absorb change. It says, don't develop where it can't absorb change. And it has some other policies that help you get there and a bunch of assessment methods that enable you to decide on a case-by-case basis whether, in fact, something adversely affects the appropriate characteristics of the appropriate area. That's what the current plan does. It doesn't prohibit things from the outset or seek to, like some of these policies do. It hasn't got a high level objective and policy, almost prohibition. It's kind of open-ended at the beginning. It's kind of enabling, but it gets tough as you go down. And, as I said, for 17 years, it's been working very well. Point eight, I say, if the panel is considering, and I use the word deliberately, elevating ONLDW to the very stringent ONLWB regime, which in my submission is what the current provisions do, with exceptional cases, for example, I submit that the panel might need to have to re-examine what constitutes an ONL in this district and apply higher guidance authority on this subject. And on attachment B, and I went, you can glance through them at your leisure, I've quoted from 1899 Manor War Station in King Salmon about outstanding, remarkable, exceptional, not the norm. A number of cases use the same terminology. And I was interested, if I can just point you to attachment B towards the bottom three, paragraph 73, where King Salmon quoted and talked about the council assessing landscapes in the Marlborough Sounds. As a whole, sounds have outstanding visual values, identified the facts that contribute within the overall Marlborough Sounds landscape. Particular landscapes are outstanding. The sounds plan describes the criteria against which the council made the assessment. Contains maps that identify those outstanding natural value, which are relatively modest given the size of the region. It's quite an interesting statement about the Marlborough Sounds. It's kind of got a bit like the Queensland Lakes District. It's full of pretty amazing stuff. It was just an interesting paragraph, I thought. And we have a plan at the moment based upon a certain kind of level of landscape analysis, which ends up with 95% ONL. And I just put that to you. And there was one other thing I was going to put to you. Sucking eggs basis, but this morning I copied out a High Country rose hip. On page 42, and this is from the Meridian case and the Lammermoor case, the Environment Court's list of matters to be examined and looked at and considered in determining an outstanding natural landscape. It's quite detailed. It requires quite a lot of assessment. And in my submission, none of the landscape evidence before you